In this podcast, we're going to explore the niche of science fiction-based old-school role-playing games. These segments started out as episodes for a science fiction-focused OSR podcast I was working on, but I've decided to do a longer show and focus on the OSR as a whole, so I'm stitching these together as best I can. Welcome to the OSR Podcast. I'm Caffeine, and this is a place for old-school role-playing games. You can find links to the show notes at caffeine.bmoment.org. Please like, subscribe, or comment, or review. So, most of us don't play as much as we'd like. We will play one-off games far more often than we'll play actually long, sustained campaigns. And a big part of this comes down to planning. Most of us don't plan. We slap together a setting, we slap together notes for adventures and a few ideas, but we don't actually plan for a group. We don't plan to get people together, to get them organized around a game that they will actually enjoy as well as we will. And to create a setting that we can actually continue to make interesting and new adventures and content for. So I'm going to kind of go over some steps on how to pull this off and get that long-running campaign we all pretty much want to be running. To start off with, start small, right? Before you actually try to pitch this to our people, come up with the basic idea, but keep it basic, okay? You're just coming up with an elevator pitch, and you want to keep it basically loose enough that you can then expand it to fit anything you want. You know, I mean, saying a space opera where you play traitors or something like that, something nice and generic, or pick a setting you like and an angle on that setting that you normally don't see, or maybe do see. Maybe you want to go with a tried and true. That's fine as well. Just pick something that can be nice and broad, right? At this stage, far more important than having a detailed setting is actually analyzing what you can put into this game. You should really pick a rule system. Don't leave it up to discussion with other players, because what's going to attract people to the game is usually going to be the rule system. People either want to play the game because they haven't tried that rule system before, or because they've used that rule system before and they prefer it. Leaving it open to "we'll decide when we get together" is going to make things kind of frustrating for the guy who shows up expecting something maybe more old school, like, you know, White Star or Starships and Spacemen, and you guys all want to play something based on Fate or some other newer school rule system. So definitely get that rule system pinned down, but then really evaluate not just what rule systems you can run, but what time you can run it. You need to make sure that you have days where you can genuinely run the game. You also need to make sure that you have days where you can write and come up with ideas for the game. This means that you may not want to do a weekly game. Even if you have a four-hour block every week where you can game, that doesn't necessarily mean you have a few hours every week to write up material for that game or to come up with material for that game. So you're going to want to basically plan out for that as well. So if you have that 4 hours a week, then you're probably going to want to do it every other week, and that gives you that 4 hours on the individual weeks in between to come up with new content, new material for your game. You know, and to be honest, I mean, there's no reason why you have to play X amount of times a month. You could have a monthly game. You could have twice a month games. Just make sure that it's something you can actually commit to and reliably do. And that's going to lead into finding your players. You need to find players who have pretty much the same expectations you do. Players who want that same time frame, who are interested in the same setting. You also want to find players who are a good mix of different player types. Now, you might be wondering what I mean by type. Well, there are a couple of books out that kind of go into really elaborate definitions of different types of players. They get into game theory, things like that. Matthew Covell gets into in his YouTube channel, he breaks it down into two kinds, players and observers. And this isn't really a bad thing, but the player is basically the one who actually engages with the world more directly. They're very much interested in changing and creating things within your world, really exploring it, playing around with it. Whereas the observer is more interested in seeing the game world unfold. You kind of need both, because the player is going to be the guy who's going to create new interesting ideas and drama in your game. But that observer is the guy who's going to actually be mentally absorbing your world and then using that to kind of go forward in the game. He's going to be the one who keeps things consistent, helps keep a consistent setting. He's also going to be the one who basically kind of helps you fill in things, because they're going to want to explore things based on things they've seen. And you can kind of combine that all together to make new things just by sort of teasing it out of them. So they're actually kind of a resource you could use in your games. They're not a detriment. And you want a good mix of these players. You don't want all incredibly active players who are all going to want to run their own way. And you don't want all observers who are just going to sit back and let you say everything. You kind of want to mix those up a bit. And you also want to make sure that they all want kind of the same tone. I mean, if one guy wants really, you know, kind of goofy off the wall game, and everybody else wants something serious based around a group of space marines dealing with PTSD and everything else, it's going to be a really weird campaign to try and run for everybody. So definitely make sure everybody's on the same page as far as the setting and everything else you want. And that all feeds into the next step, which is have a meeting of all the players to actually discuss the setting. This is where you're going to get into those specifics. This is where you're going to start deciding on the key NPCs, the key groups and governments and societies or anything in your game. You're going to bounce these ideas off of each other a bit. As a game master, you need to be the one directing this, obviously, but you want them to start discussing the kinds of players they want to play, the kinds of backgrounds those players may have. You'll start bouncing around ideas for NPCs who could fit into that. And by the end of the planning session, you should really actually have a pretty decent sketch of your setting. You're going to have to fill in the fine details, come up with all the extra governments, all the extra stuff, all the stuff you want to throw at them later on. But you should have a lot of things about the characters, their backgrounds. Those backgrounds will probably give you some setting elements that you're going to want to throw in there for not just for them, but to help root them into the game. And actually letting them come up with backstory will also help you then come up with future adventures based on backstory elements. If they have a father who's, you know, running away or something, he can be pulled in later as an NPC. And that's going to bring in all the stuff coming in behind that background as well. So your planning session is actually the best resource you're going to have for filling in your game. And it's going to make sure that you have a game the players want to play and you want to run. This should be partially negotiation. Nobody's going to get everything they want, but you should all get enough of what you want that you can actually enjoy playing the game. Because something we sometimes forget, especially people who like to run the games, we'll get so deep into running it that we forget it's a game. This is a hobby. We're not getting paid. It's not a job. We need to have fun. Even the game master is supposed to have fun. Unless, of course, he is getting paid. That's a weird phenomenon that's come up. But for most of us, you're not getting paid. This is for fun, and the planning session helps you make sure you're all going to have fun and make sure that they're going to get a game that is going to engage them, that's going to tell the stories they want to tell, and it's going to be something you're going to enjoy running and something you're going to enjoy creating for and telling. Right? And then after the planning session, don't have your characters meet in a tavern. If you have to come up with some cheesy contrivance like that to get the players together, you didn't do your planning session right. By the end of the planning session, you should know how your players get together. It should all, in fact, some of them should already maybe be in contact with each other, because you should actually encourage them to create backgrounds that lead into one another. So when you get to that first session, you can hit the ground running with actually a really great adventure. Some people, I've noticed there's a tendency for people to want to actually start playing at the planning session. I have mixed feelings about that. I don't like to do it, but I've often found that if I don't do it, I lose some of the players because they don't turn up the next session. People have limited time, especially adult players. You know, I'm in my 30s. A lot of people I try to play with are around the same age, you know, late 20s, early 40s kind of range. And we don't have a lot of time. We have families, we have jobs. So trying to squeeze in any game time is hard enough, and if we don't actually get to game of that session, it feels like we've lost something. You can kind of make up for this a little bit if it's a face-to-face game and not an online game by having the planning meeting somewhere that's fun to go to anyway, so you all kind of enjoy yourselves anyway. That could be its own can of worms, though, if you're actually enjoying yourself too much to do the planning properly, if it's too distracting. But basically, if you can manage it and you can find people who have the right temperament, definitely have the planning session separate from gaming. If you can't, just after you've got the planning done and you've got that basic stuff, you can actually do that this is how you meet session at the end of your planning. You know, you play maybe an hour at most. And you can take the threads you built up in the planning session and sort of pull those together in that first little short session, and then come back with the adventure you actually wrote based on your notes from the planning session. However you end up doing that, though, your first game session should definitely be far more developed than if you hadn't done the planning session. You should already know what their motivations are, their interests, what the campaign's going to be about. It shouldn't be a prepackaged adventure with a bunch of dawdling. You can use prepackaged material, But after the planning session, you should have enough notes to really adapt that to what you all want to run. And I suppose the biggest part of all this is to build that player engagement, because player engagement is what creates campaigns. You need things that are going to bring those people back week after week, month after month, to have that long-running campaign, or else it's just going to be another one-shot. And there's nothing wrong with one-shots, but the point of this podcast is basically to help you come up with a way not to just have a one-shot. So for the sake of argument, let's say it's not what you want. Then you need to get those players engaged, right? Their character has to have an interesting story coming up. This isn't necessarily to say that you have to let the players all create their own little special snowflakes. You don't have to give in to the new school attitude that player characters should pretty much be immune to everything. You can definitely kill off a player character in the first few sessions. But when you do that planning session, you should have enough material there and enough of an idea of what everybody wants and everything that when that player's character does die, if he dies, I'm not saying specifically to go out and kill him off, but if it happens, he should have somewhere to go from there immediately. You should have somewhere to put him from there immediately. He should have another character able to be lined up or an idea or somewhere to pull from or another interesting idea. It shouldn't be the end for him, or it shouldn't be something so frustrating that he rolls up some character, you just have him show up, and then he never comes back to game session again because you've completely broken his engagement. So, again, you can still have that old school sensibility while building the campaign if you do it right. So it all really does hinge on that planning session. And then going forward, the biggest thing to remember is that you are managing the campaign, you are running your sessions. And by that I mean campaign management, you're coming up with ideas, you're coordinating things, you're coming up with plot lines, whereas when you're actually at the session, that's when you're running, that's when you're playing as a GM. So one is basically more directly creative, the other one is more logistic within creative elements. So you're basically, it's sort of the logistics of creativity. You're going to want to plan out when you can have your games. Like I said, if you did all your prep work right, this is going to be easy because you've already decided what amount of time you can commit. This is a point where you then make sure you commit. If you say you're going to have that game every other week, you need to make sure you have that game every other week. If a couple of players don't show up, they don't show up, you still showed up, you are still going to run it, right? That's what's going to keep people coming back, is that feeling of consistency. And if you only have one or two players, you should still have some material around that you can use with just one or two players and not the whole group. And in fact, that actually is a great way to sort of kind of pull a Star Wars and build up an expanded universe. If you, by trying to be consistent like this, happen to end up running a session where only one or two players shows up, you can use that session to run a side quest. You can run something that those characters did before these events, or if their characters happen to be away from the other characters at the time anyway, you can then fill in that. So you can kind of use that to actually enrich your world. So don't ever see it as like you taking a chance on it and getting hosed. You've just created another chance to sort of build things up. A great way to sort of add to this is, even if nobody shows up, if you happen to be running this at like a gaming store or you're running this online, you can see if you can pull other people in sort of a pickup game thing to run stuff in your setting. And then you can have that actually affect what the players do. So if you have a session where everybody flakes for whatever reason, maybe you find out later they all had valid reasons, maybe you don't, but you didn't flake, you might feel cheated. But if you then use that to run a session for a bunch of newer gamers who happen to be at the game store, even if none of them show any real interest in continuing to play in your actual campaign, what they did in that session can roll into the expanded universe of your campaign. In fact, that's actually another key point, is the idea of the expanded universe, right? If you're managing your campaign properly, as opposed to trying to run the campaign, if you're managing it, you will naturally develop this sort of extended universe, actually gonna make the thing richer. And if you're the kind of person who likes running games, this should be the kind of thing you want. Because basically, people who continually game master, the game for us is building those worlds, building that settings, having that rich environment, seeing other people explore the things we've created, and actually create within that creation. You know, I mean, that's kind of what the character is doing, is he's affecting the world around himself. I should say the player's doing is having the character affect the world around himself, and that helps build that world that you had in your head into something more interesting than you would have created on your own. if you've seen the prequels to Star Wars, you kind of know when he's allowed to be individually creative, he's not as good as when he collaborates. And I think that's something that also is true of role-playing games. You know, it's that mix of all the players and the Game Master bouncing off each other. And the neat thing about what I was just saying, though, is it doesn't have to be necessarily your players. Anything, if you're managing the campaign correctly, can make your game more interesting. This also rolls into the idea that TSR used to run with the living campaigns, where you would actually have a campaign world that was being run by many different Game Masters, and the RPGA would actually be coordinating that to then have the different groups' events actually affect the campaign world, thus giving the setting of a sort of like a modern MMORPG. It would actually be a bigger, richer world for all these people playing. Which is a huge aside to the fact that even if you show up and nobody's there, you can still run things, you can still have fun. And if you're running something at home and nobody shows up, yeah, you may have a wasted night. But that's that night, maybe you write a little more for your game. Maybe you do a little extra planning. And, of course, after you make sure that all the players are going to show up the next time, that's when you have things spring on them, because the game world was still running while they weren't there. So, again, consistency should not be seen as taking a chance. It should be seen as a chance to actually help build the game into something more interesting for you. And it's also the best way to retain those players, because if you feel like everybody's going to flake, so you decide to flake, the couple people who were going to show up aren't necessarily going to feel that committed next time. And if a lot of this feels like it's coming from self-help books, it actually has. Lately, I've been reading a few different role-playing game kind of self-help books, and I'm going to do a review on them in a bit. A lot of them are from the Goodman Games line that they did recently, or not recently, it's actually been a few years. And then you have stuff like Dirty Tricks from Bill Webb, things like that. Venger Zaytanis' How to Game Master Like a Boss. And it's kind of a weird genre of book to read, is a self-help book for role players. But I'm actually finding that it's really helping me understand some of the mistakes I made in running games in the past. So it's really helping to enrich my games. I will provide links to a couple of the ones that actually helped influence this podcast. There's one really good one about campaign management, which is why I've been talking about campaign management. And that one I'll definitely link as well in the show notes. I'll also link some stuff to different sci-fi games to help you get started with rule systems. In the kind of old school sphere, we have a couple of big ones now. Starships and Spacemen, White Star, I'll link to those. But then there's also kind of a plethora of other ones floating around out there. And there's stuff that was kind of popped up at one point and never really touched on very much later, like Explorers. So again, I'll link to all that kind of stuff in the bottom so you can kind of get an idea of what's out there for running your own games. And I really hope this has helped you kind of get a grip on how you might want to run your own games in the future. Now, a topic I really love, not to start any conflict between Star Trek and Star Wars. I like them both, but I've always been a little more into Star Trek, especially early Trek. When you're talking about old school role-playing games with regards to Star Trek, there are really two main ones and a few lesser ones we could go over. I would consider FOSS's Star Trek RPG from back in the day to be an old school role-playing game. It's based on Traveler. But I'm not going to talk about that today. I may talk about that in a future podcast. I haven't really played that one very much, and I haven't read all the rule books yet, so I couldn't really speak competently on it anyway. In the OSR, there are really two role-playing games that kind of cover Star Trek. One is Five-Year Mission from Ivanhoe Unbound. It's actually a supplement to the White Star role-playing game, which is really popular right now, which means it's also compatible with all of the Swords and Wizardry white box material as well. So, if you want to play a Starfleet captain with a ranger as an officer, you probably could. The other option is Starships and Spacemen from Goblinoid Games, which is one I actually really like. It's compatible with all their Labyrinth Lord stuff. And of course, because these two systems are fairly similar, they're pretty intercompatible with each other. The main difference in Starships and Spacemen is they've changed around the presentation of things like the attack tables and that, so it looks dramatically different, but the math actually works out to be about the same. Now, one thing Starships and Spacemen does that the White Box stuff normally doesn't is it uses a separate racing class because it's based around the assumption that you're going to play Starfleet officers. They aren't called Starfleet in the setting, but you're going to play ship's officers who are coming from multiple races, mostly human, but a few others. It interestingly has one group of humans who are sort of evolutionarily deviant from humans. They've split off. I would say this is based on Gene Roddenberry's other work, Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, with the Nietzschean race. But this game actually came out a very long time ago. Goblinoid Games bought the rights to an early Star Trek knockoff game from way back when, and updated it to match their newer rule system. So I believe they're called Regellians. I don't think they're actually a copy at all. That game is based around a lot of premises that match Star Trek. One it doesn't is their ships are smaller, so they're shorter range. They don't have ships as big as the Enterprise. But the rules detail a few different systems. There's also a supplement that details a whole new system, which adds in a bunch of other races that are sort of Star Trek races with the serial numbers filed off. So it's a really interesting game. It's compatible with Mutant Future, so you can use that to generate kind of freaky mutants for them to run into on some planets if you want to. It's also the rule system they used for their Planet of the Apes based game called Apes Victorious, and that one you can actually use to add apes to your game if you wanted to for some reason. 5-Year Mission, on the other hand, seeks to sort of wrangle White Star into the kind of a setting that matches up closer to Star Trek. It, in some ways, I don't feel it does it as well. It kind of sticks to races class, which is a concept I really love in classic D&D. And I even can like it in a lot of sci-fi. In something like Star Wars or something, you know, the aliens are mostly going to be a little more stereotypical of their type. At least the ones who are going to deal with humans. So you're not going to see a ton of diversity. You might want to have, like, multiple alien race classes available in case you want to play, say, a Wookiee warrior versus a Wookiee engineer, but being a Wookiee is still going to be a big part of that character no matter what, because that's the way Star Wars presented aliens to people. In Star Trek, because aliens are generally divorced from a lot of their character traits, are treated as, well, just people with these few alien qualities, which, because it's good and it's bad, it often gets mocked. It doesn't make as much sense to have races class. That said, I can kind of get past it because 5-Year Mission adds some interesting concepts, which, while they don't actually match the expectations of Star Trek, are still really interesting. Things like playing a sentient starship, adding in the Star Knights and stuff from White Star into a more Star Trek type setting. It kind of is a little more gonzo, but it could still work to kind of simulate sort of a Star Trek type setting. And I keep using that phrase, Star Trek type setting. So let me get into the meat of what this podcast is about. Playing Star Trek in a role-playing game doesn't necessarily mean you have to use the setting. It's nice, but you don't have to. You can actually skip a lot of what Trek is and play your own game based loosely on it. You just probably wouldn't want to call it Star Trek. Hint, hint to the newer movies. But you could do that, and it would work just fine. The thing to keep in mind, though, are the core expectations of sort of Star Trek's own Starfleet-esque genre of role-playing, or rather genre of science fiction, which is that it's optimistic. It usually assumes that things are going to get better and things are going in a good direction. Bad things happen. They can happen for a while. You have a lot of the neutral zones, you have complex political situations in which they explored a lot in The Next Generation. But even though bad things can happen, even though bad things continue to happen, generally speaking, advancement, science, cultural integration, friendships, that's all going to build us a better world. That's what Star Trek is about. Another big thing is there's no big bad in the Star Trek universe. They aren't fighting an empire. They aren't raging against a corrupt society. There aren't hordes of aliens at the edge of known space on their way there with a ticking time clock. There have periodically been all these things for short periods of time, but Star Trek is essentially episodic because it's always worked best as a TV show. And so the characters aren't fighting against the horrible evil, it's just during this period of time they're doing this thing. The general thing they're fighting against is much broader and much less easy to simplify into one common element, and that is just ignorance, short-sightedness, hatred, war, hunger, all the bads of societies. That's what Star Trek is against. Star Trek is a setting about not just living in a utopia, but continuing to build one. That's if you want to play Star Trek according to what actually was pushed out by the show, which is an awesome way to play Star Trek. I love Star Trek. I think all that stuff's pretty great. The flip side, though, is you could actually make Star Trek a pretty dark society if you wanted to. And it would still technically be a Star Trek style of, you know, storytelling. Because what you could do is latch on to the fact that there's no new media in Star Trek. In no Star Trek episodes do you see music or anything coming out of the Federation after relatively modern times. Almost all the music they listen to, the stuff they simulate in the holodecks, all the references they make are pretty much cultural references to our culture. Now, in reality, this is because these shows were written by our culture. But in setting, it could be that they're just not that creative anymore. Maybe there's just a point where a society, without constant influence, and when it reaches a sort of peak of stability and calmness, just gets boring. Which would also explain why they're always sending incredibly advanced ships, chock full of people, to the edge of known space just to find things, right? Just to find novelty. They're so interested in meeting new cultures because they want something new, something interesting. They're bored out of their minds. It's not so much a horrible dystopian dictatorship as it is just a really dull society that's trying to get out of its funk. That has some value, too. You can also get into themes of cultural appropriation. I know that word's tossed around a lot these days, but I mean it in its more true sense. Namely, these people are just hungry for other people's culture. It becomes a fad. They benefit from it, and then don't really push that benefit back to the original people at all if they don't have to. And then they move on to the next one when they find something else. After that's been so thoroughly integrated into their culture, it's now boring as well. You can also go even darker and focus on the fact that almost every commander you see in the show is horribly corrupt. They did a Cracked episode of this on YouTube not that long ago. Kind of a fun watch. And they really explored sort of the, like, how horribly corrupt and dark the Federation could potentially be if these, all these evil, you know, commanders and everything else we see in the show are representative of the actual, like, Admiralty and everything else in the Federation. It could be horribly corrupt, and they're constantly sending their ship out to the edge of space, so they're nowhere near the center to figure out what's going on. You can also, you know, look at the fact that the Federation sometimes finds out they're wrong. I mean, we all think of that episode with the epic fight between Kirk and the Gorn captain, and most of us probably don't remember that in that episode, they actually discover, through a little research on the back end, that the reason why the Gorn were attacking them in the first place is that the Federation had actually encroached on their territory. So, in truth, the Gorn were actually in the right in that situation, and the Federation was in the wrong. There's also the, I hate to bring it up because it is so sanctimonious and such a terrible episode, but the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where they have to displace a colony of Native Americans who had settled on a distant world and made sort of a new North American homeland for themselves there. That episode was heavy-handed and poorly written, and it honestly made Will Wheaton look even more annoying than he had been in the show up till then. No dig against Will Wheaton, the dude's awesome. But Wesley Crusher, he did the best he could with a terrible character. I'm sorry, that's just how I feel. But that episode was terrible, but did show the Federation being in the wrong again. Then you have most of the episodes in Star Trek where the Federation is in the wrong are not that great episodes, with the exception of the Gorn Captain. Because I'm also going to bring up the movie in which they had to move the Sol, I believe they're called, from their homeworld. Terrible episode there, too. Terrible movie. Well, I didn't like it. But, you know, a lot of those kinds of things where they kind of play the Federation as evil are also bad episodes. But you could use those as threads to build an interesting campaign over a corrupt version of the Federation, sort of a shadow Federation. And your characters could play against the big bad. Wouldn't really be, it would kind of go against what I said earlier about what makes something a Star Trek-type setting. But it could work as a new, interesting, different sort of a setting. Something that is against an evil empire, but not Star Wars. The other key things, though, to kind of remember are that if you're playing in a setting like this with a power structure, your characters are going to have roles within that power structure. They're probably going to have ranks. Unless you choose to play a campaign where they're like traitors or pirates or something else in the same setting. If they're part of the Federation and they're on a Federation ship. They're probably going to have a rank and a role. They're going to have access to equipment, but there's not going to be the kind of purchasing equipment phase in the game. It's all going to be what's issued, and they'll have the ability to requisition, that sort of thing. They'll move up through the power structure. They'll have to follow commands. All that's going to be Star Trek-y, and it's probably going to be a little different because a lot of sci-fi RPGs tend to avoid putting you smack dab in the center of a command structure because of these problems. You know, in Traveler, you usually play a bunch of traitors or free roamers going out and doing their own things after having been in a long military career. In a lot of other games, you play, you know, everything from traitors to mercenaries, merchants, all kinds, usually something that gets you a ship and gets you traveling a lot. And in Star Trek, you get a ship and you get traveling a lot, but there's also the responsibility to the Federation. So that would be another element you would want to bring into the game if you want something that feels like Star Trek. A command structure that is stable, well-managed, and that your characters have to work within adds to it as well. That also comes down to things like the Prime Directive and all the other major directives and rules of Star Trek. Your characters will actually have rules they will have to play with. And this actually could give you a handy use for the alignment system in D&D, where you could have, at one end of the alignment, right, complete compliance, and at the other end of the alignment, being a complete rogue, going against compliance with the Federation. So it's one of those cases where old-school D&D could actually work really well for this kind of a game, because there's a concept, which even though a lot of people argue about its usefulness in D&D in general, in this special circumstance, could actually be really handy. Now, as I was talking about earlier, the idea of race as class, in Star Trek, to really get that, I feel like you would have to kind of abandon it. You could sort of make it work. Most of the characters we see on board the ship are kind of a one-note stereotype of their race. Spock is purely logical. Worf is a warrior. You know, they're all sort of a stereotype, sort of an extreme. But we do see examples of those kinds of races in this setting, in the Federation, that are not those extremes, right? We see Vulcans who are a little more flexible about things. We see Vulcans who have different attitudes from Spock. So I feel like it couldn't work, but I think that may just be my own bias. It may work very well. So, you know, when I'm going down the elements of things that don't really work for kind of a Star Trek RPG, I guess this is sort of something that there's some flex on. But I think the biggest thing to remember is, well, obviously, first thing to remember is always have fun, no matter what you're playing. But the second thing to remember is that it's optimistic. Just always remember there's going to be good stuff coming along, that things are going better. The story is about making peace with other races that you might be in conflict with, not engaging the conflict, not increasing the war. When it does go that way, that is actually usually shown in the setting to be a failing of the Federation, not it at its best, not where it's supposed to be going. Which I think is something that, again, going back to my earlier point, they're forgetting in a lot of the newer stuff, is that it's supposed to be optimistic, it's supposed to be good, and sometimes they go back on that. That's why I was also saying that if you wanted to play that setting, you'd kind of have to tug at the threads from the episodes where it didn't work as well. When I reached out for comments about what to actually do on this podcast, I got some requests for plot hooks, especially plot hooks for science fiction games like White Star and Starships and Spacemen. I thought that some good ones would actually be focused on this, a rather particular subset of the science fiction genre, specifically space science fiction. In science fiction, there is the idea of a colony ship, which precedes a colony. Usually, when we're talking about colonizing the stars, we only talk about the ship as a vessel for it. But in science fiction, it's often the actual source of the adventuring. It's where most of it's going to take place. A lot of times, they'll do a generation ship. But to be honest, long-term space colonization is probably not going to be very feasible with a generation ship. You're going to need some form of stasis. That's just because you can't guarantee that the people who started the trip are going to be the same culture, species, etc. as people who end it if you've got many, 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 many generations in between. This is specifically why science fiction loves a generation ship. So what I'm going to be talking about mostly, though, is the idea of a failed colony ship. So we're going to skip over generation ships at first. I'm actually going to go over at the end an idea I have for how a generation ship could really work, so you could have something like your Metamorphosis Alpha and still have it be a little more feasible. But in general, I'm going to be talking about stasis ships. And the idea there is that you come up with some technology which allows you to put a body into stasis so that you can put someone in stasis at the departure, wake them up at the destination, and for them, effectively, no or very little time has passed. The main way of doing this in most science fiction is usually a system of chemicals, cold storage, that sort of thing. Other systems kind of use an idea which makes more sense, which is a stasis field. Basically, it's a strong magnetic field that prevents the molecules from moving. No molecules moving, no time passing. There are some physics-y issues with what happens after that, because obviously once you remove the stasis field, the molecules no longer have an orientation. Like, as I'm walking forward, all my molecules are going forward, right? There's momentum, there's inertia, all those things are acting on them. When you put it in stasis, that goes away. So when you take it out of stasis, what do the molecules do immediately before everything sort of kickstarts is a question. But the assumption in science fiction is these kinds of weird science problems have been solved. So in a generation ship, most of the stuff that's going to go wrong then is going to be at the destination, or whether or not they actually reach the destination. So let's start with that idea. You could base a lot of weird adventures on trying to figure out what happened to colony ships that didn't end up where they were supposed to be, right? If you're playing a science fiction game based on, you know, some kind of federation, or even conversely, if you don't want to have a big government, or there's a big government but you don't want your characters to be a part of it, you could actually have them as a salvage crew, right? Trying to hunt down these lost generation ships for the salvage, because even if you don't play in a setting which allows for things like slavery, which your players may not want to do even if your setting does allow for it, you do have the option of selling those colonists as a resource, because they're probably now, even if the ship is, you know, hundreds and hundreds and, or thousands of years, you know, delayed, there are probably still cultures and civilizations that need colonists for various reasons. And when these people wake up, they're going to need jobs, or they're going to need something to do, especially if their colony world, which this is another topic I'll cover in a little bit, if their colony world's already been colonized by a subsequent crew, then they need somewhere to go. So it's not so much selling them as it is playing the agent. You know, you wake the command crew of them up, you figure out where they're supposed to go, that sort of thing. So having your characters hunt down these ships can be a fun game. It also can be kind of a mystery game, because it's kind of a murder mystery, right? Figuring out what sent them off course, if it's still affecting the ship. Are there weird aliens on board? Is there some damage that's irradiating things that they have to solve? Do they have to get the ship out of some tricky situation? Like, is it stuck in a gravity well of a black hole? Something fun like that. Kind of like in Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, when they have to pull the ship out of a black hole's gravity well to salvage it and then find that the crew's still alive. This may be the case with a generation ship. Another fun option for a plot hook is when the characters go to maybe verify a colony for a government or some other organization, and that colony is not there, and then they have to figure out where that ship ended up. So your characters could then have to find where those colonists ended up, the planet they're on, discover a colony that's not supposed to be there, a colony that may be different from what they expected, maybe a colony that is now in political problems because it developed where it wasn't supposed to be, and it's some other group or organization space. Maybe there was another colony ship that was supposed to land on that planet. They took it first. And so now there was like a, there's been an ongoing war between the two colonial groups. All kinds of really complex stuff you can do with that idea of the ship that didn't go where it was supposed to. So you got the idea of a stasis ship just floating out in space somewhere you're sort of harvesting for resources. You've got the idea of a ship you're finding a purpose for that you found out in space. You've got the idea of a ship that has landed somewhere unexpected. And the other thing with the unexpected idea is you could also have, like, what if the world they were heading for had already been, you know, checked out and unlikely to contain any life. Then the world they actually ended up on had native biosystem. Maybe they terraformed the planet, but there's still all these weird organisms. Maybe, kind of conversely, they had to bioform themselves. They had to alter themselves to adapt to the local ecology and to eat the local biological life. These people may be very alien by the time humans actually show up to contact them. You also could do something like the setting Defiance does. They had a I have never actually played the game Defiance. I've seen the show Defiance, but in the show, a group of aliens show up and try to colonize Earth, dumping all of their terraforming stuff. But the terraforming tries, instead of actually terraforming it, bioforms local organisms. Because the process is interrupted, it doesn't go all the way through, and so you have all these weird hybrid Earth alien animals running around in the wilds, hybrid Earth alien plants, and weird alien ecosystems. So reverse could happen. You'd still end up with the same weirdness, so that could also make for some really fun adventuring. In fact, if you didn't even want to explore space in your science fiction game, you could actually just have them exploring this weird world that's happened from it. Another thought, it's a dead colony world, right? You get there, and the entire civilization is come and gone, right? The colonists landed, they built out their colony, lived there for several generations, achieved whatever they achieved, and now they're all dead. Maybe, for reasons you don't really know, they actually exceeded the baseline civilization they came from. Maybe you come to a planet that is full of superstructures, or maybe the solar system itself is full of superstructures. I mean, it'd be really weird for a civilization that doesn't have the technology to build something like a Dyson swarm, which is a swarm of orbital habitats, solar collectors, completely encompassing a star. It's not necessarily a solid object. It could just be tons and tons of little objects that pretty much completely consume the energy of a star that's being output. You could have a group of human adventurers from an advanced civilization that sent out colonists showing up to a colony system expecting to find people who were a little bit regressed because they had to rebuild after they got there, and instead mysteriously finding a system chock full of megastructures that have sort of human, like, evidence that they were built by humans. That could be a really interesting story, because how'd they get so advanced so fast? What did they discover that the baseline civilization didn't, or who contacted them and gave them access to that technology could also be interesting. Even something really simple, like you wouldn't necessarily have to have a whole system full of it, because that'd be really hard as a game master if your players suddenly said they wanted to explore each and every object. But you could do something like, there's this idea for getting people into orbit from Earth of a ring around a planet. And you could actually get one of those in a Lagrange point kind of orbit between the Earth and the Moon, and you could theoretically have a space elevator running up from the Earth to that ring, and then a secondary run running from the ring to the Moon. These could be on tracks on the inside and outside of the ring, so you could have a continuous method of transit from a planet to its moon. Imagine finding one of those in a science fiction setting where that kind of super technology is not very common outside of a few really advanced core worlds, you know. And then, of course, there's no people around, or there are people, but they're like the degenerate descendants, you know, kind of like in Larry Niven's Ringworld, when you show up there and there's clearly evidence of an advanced society, and this advanced society was obviously related to humans somehow, but the humans they actually find are these degenerate offshoots. You could have the similar situation there. Another idea pops into mind is, what if humans get there, develop their society, but find that they're not well suited to it? Like, what if they aren't well suited to the environmental conditions? What if there's a disease that's slowly killing them off? What if they decide that they're just kind of giving up on civilization? If they have technology which allows them to live forever, maybe they all just decide to take that and are just waiting out the clock. So in that case, you might have that society create other advanced intelligent life forms to sort of pick up the slack, to sort of continue the torch of civilization. And then these torch carrier civilizations, you could have something. The weird thing to me, whenever I watch a movie by like Pixar or Disney or whatever, where it's full of anthropomorphic animals, is that there's a lot of weird inconsistencies. Why are there so many different species of anthropomorphic animal just living together? What about normal animals? Do they exist? What do the carnivores eat if they don't exist? Who made them? Why are they all vaguely human? Why does their civilization look a lot like ours? You know, like movies like Sing, or the one with the rabbit and the fox that escapes me recently. These worlds actually would make sense if you assumed that they're a result of a human colony where the humans were in decline, and so they started creating all these sort of uplifted animal species to replace humanity, And they were sort of experimenting by having them all compete against each other. In this kind of society, it wouldn't necessarily be antagonistic between the individual species. They may not care. They may not even be aware that they're competing. It may literally be that the humans at the core of all this are just watching the statistics to see which one fares the best. Or it may be actively competitive. This may be a culture where each and every sort of genetic experimental group is competing against all the others. It may be a meritocracy, with the idea that eventually one of these genetic groups is going to become the dominant one. Many of these creatures may not even resemble just anthropomorphic animals. They may resemble really weird alien things that are combinations of different Earth creature traits. So you can really kind of spiral off with that in all kinds of directions. So you also have an entire civilization where it's a machine intelligence that succeeded humans. You know, we could get to a colony and find out that the humans died, but the robots just kept on keeping on and became more and more advanced. Another idea is, there's this idea that if you upload your consciousness to a machine, you could live forever. But there's a competing and somewhat more substantiated, based on what we know about neurology, argument that if you did that, you would really just be dying and leaving a computer that thinks like you behind. Which, depending upon your opinion of continuity, may or may not be a good thing. To a lot of people, that would basically mean you're dead. So you could have an entire human species, which technically went extinct, but their consciousnesses, they uploaded to computers, and those live on as machine intelligences, in which case the human race is technically extinct, but also technically not. The other fun bit with that could be that maybe they thought ahead of time they had a way of preserving the person in the upload, and then after the fact, when everybody's already been uploaded, they develop years later and realize, nope, we're all just copies. The psychological issues with a society like that could be really, really, really interesting to explore as well. It kind of... I'm targeting this podcast more at the old school Renaissance, but a lot of these concepts are kind of coming from more modern RPGs that explore culture and things like that. You can still do that in an OSR game. The difference is, while you're exploring all this stuff, you have to make sure that there's a lot of good old-fashioned adventures, fights, that sort of thing, to keep that OSR spirit alive, right? Because OSR is about more about adventure gaming than about elaborate galactic plots. The elaborate galactic plot is the thing justifying the adventure gaming. So in all these cases, right, there is an adventure to be found, right? Exploration, kind of space dungeons and all the ruins. In fact, I'm going to do another podcast about the idea of a space dungeon, because I've always loved the game Metamorphosis Alpha. So you have the adventure of exploring ruins, of exploring worlds, of dealing with these cultures that have gone weird or divergent, maybe having to fight your way out of a capital city of some really divergent culture who you've just discovered has some weird tradition that is just unconscionable, and you have to get this information back. Warfare, conflict, all the fun. And especially if you have a more primitive colony world, you can explore it and deal with all these factions and cultures, but not be as overwhelmed as you would with a more advanced one. You know what I mean? Like in an advanced society, you're dealing with cops and you're basically trying to escape a world gone mad, whereas with a more primitive society, you're mostly fighting off the primitives, and if you get away from them, you know, after X amount of cities, they don't chase you anymore. So there, you can get out of trouble and still explore the world. And with most ones on colony ships, again, space dungeons. So all that's kind of fun. Now, I said at the beginning, I was also going to dig a little more into the idea of a generation ship. So the kind of common idea of the generation ship, the one you see in the TV show The Star Lost, the book Nonstop, the game Metamorphosis Alpha, that idea has a lot of problems. It's mostly because of the plausibility. There isn't a lot of reason for a culture to ever create a ship like that. Because the only real reason to send out colony ships would be to advance your own culture, your own civilization, to not keep all of our eggs in one basket. The problem is, with a colony, it's hard enough to see that continuity, because humans on another world are going to develop on their own path, in their own way, and that colony may not be anything like our culture, and the species that eventually generations down the road develops there may not be anything like what would have lived on Earth. So you don't really have that continuity necessarily. That's hard, but it's plausible to see them as a continuation. With a colony ship, that's a generation ship, before they've even actually got to the new world, they've already experienced, you know, a dozen generations of change. So there's very little motivation because there's no way to guarantee by the time they get there, they're even going to be a technological society. Which is the fun in a lot of the games like Metamorphosis Alpha. So you can still have that kind of a game. You can still play Metamorphosis Alpha and enjoy it. It's just one of those cases where you have to sort of turn your brain off for that part. You know what I mean? It's the mindless fun, which is still fun. But a more plausible version of that is a group that doesn't want to live on Earth taking one of those ships long range with the expectation that their culture is going to grow and develop in isolation before it gets to any world that it would want to inhabit anyway. You could do something like this by building, say, an O'Neill cylinder, you know, a rotating habitat inside of some really large object, possibly a big spherical object, actually, because you can put the cylinder down the center and then store everything else in zero G around it, and then have ship systems control all that. A really big habitat might not be super plausible to travel in, but you can still have a fairly large one and be all right. So imagine, say, a future where some religion, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever, is almost extinct, right? There's no religion that's the vast majority that's more or less taken over, and they're religious dissidents. They may want to preserve their culture in the same way the pilgrims who went to Amsterdam but then eventually decided to colonize North America did by leaving. And a colony ship like this would be a great thing because they can continue their own isolated cultural evolution in transit. So that would be pretty attractive to a group like that. Also, if you have a technological society where making these kinds of ships was not actually expensive for them, if they just send out a group of, you know, swarm droids to the Oort cloud and they just build hundreds of thousands of these ships and replace their own number on their own, and it's this thing that just kind of perpetually goes on its own, you could have a culture like that, basically offering colony ships to anybody who doesn't like the way things are. Any political dissidents they want to get rid of, anybody who disagrees, you just, hey, here's a colony ship, go do your own thing. I remember a short story, and I can't remember the name of it for the life of me, where the premise was that humanity's kind of main learning coming out of all of our wars and our history is that you should never have to live near anybody you don't like. And that was, in that setting, the impetus for colonizing the stars. And that actually is kind of plausible. If you have the technology to just build colony ships without it being a big deal, you could shoot these things off every few years and just send out any politically dissident group that you don't like. That, like, if there's a group that just can't stand the way things are, here you go. Here's your colony ship. Go, you know, reproduce and develop your culture through interstellar space. If you have access to something like fusion technology, it would not be implausible to bring enough energy with you to actually power yourselves through a long interstellar journey. And by the time you get to somewhere where there might be a planet that you might want to colonize, that descendant culture of yours could do so. So there's, like, for a group like that, there would be both interest in the travel and in the endpoint. And then for a, let's say you had this culture that was sending these ships out, that culture collapses or changes or whatever. But eventually, the people of the old Earth system develop faster than light travel. What do they find when they get out there? And that can be really fun, because all of the things I said about colony worlds and colony ships would also apply to these long generation ships. And then you have your Metamorphosis Alpha fun. You have your Star Lost kind of fun where you can explore these. You could actually run the adventure with the character starting on the ship, or you could use something like this and add it as a plot hook to your own existing adventure game. So, you know, I hope those are some really neat plot hooks that help you kind of fill in a game session you weren't planning on running, or maybe even start a campaign. I mean, you don't, when you're talking about like colony worlds and stuff, they're worlds. There's enough there to run your own game for forever if you want to. There's a, don't want to reference too much stuff out of the OSR because I'm trying to target this podcast at the OSR, but there is a game out there called Mindjammer, which is largely focused on just these kind of colonies. So you can run whole campaigns there. And in an adventure game like classic D&D type games like Traveler, these can be explored ad nauseum pretty much forever. you could have a game where you're just playing
you know, members of a cargo ship who go to places, who bring trade goods to planets that are supposed to have a colony based on ancient records, and then travel between them. And it could be like a Monster of the Week game, where anytime you come upon an interesting one that the players actually show a lot of interest in, you could just adventure there for several sessions before you move on. Like, it's pretty easy to expand. So I really hope this has helped you out in thinking along those lines and then adding something really fun to your games. Well, I hope these segments have helped you get your science fiction games up and running. The old school is really great for sci-fi. At least for very specific niches, and I hope I've really shown you how you can kind of explore those and give a little more depth to your game. Please visit my website at caffeine.bvomit.org for links and show notes. Let me know what you think. I'm Caffeine. Over and out.